Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Lisa Simeone. I have three friends who teach in the Baltimore City public schools. As you can imagine, it's no picnic. One of them is very experienced. He's been teaching for 18 years. One has been teaching for 5 years. The other is a newbie in his second year of teaching. They've all had opportunities to teach in less troublesome schools, including private schools, but they believe they have a mission. They're dedicated. Like many teachers, they often have to use their own money to buy school supplies for their students. Something that's out of their price range, though, is modern technology, computers. These days, education includes at least some familiarity with computers. Not only are students expected to know how to use them, but teachers are expected to incorporate them in their curriculum. But what works and what doesn't? What techniques in the classroom will bear fruit? Producer Richard Paul attempts to answer those questions in today's Soundprint, Teaching the Next Generation.
The past has been a mint of blood and sorrow. This must not be true of tomorrow.
Teachers, they're there during the most formative moments of your life.
I've heard some people say, history doesn't mean anything, right? It was 500 years ago. What does that have to do with today?
If you add up the hours you spend at school, especially if your parents work, you may have actually spent more time in school with teachers than with your family.
I wasn't able to get my syllabus signed. Can I turn it on Monday?
Monday, yes. Monday for sure, though.
Of course, there were the ones who, now you know, were just punching the clock, the ones you blame for not understanding geometry or spelling. But there were also the other ones, the ones you treasure, who you thank when you're named president of the Chamber of Commerce or when you win the Academy Award.
Workers! And you're all going to say, yeah, we're workers. She's going to say, are you unhappy with your pay? And you're all going to say, yeah. And she's going to say, look, if you join this union, we can go together and I'll demand this.
Teachers, what makes a good one? The experts have their opinions. They'll tell you that good teachers
really say that it's my job and these are my students and I am going to do the best job that I can for these kids, and if I don't do it, you know, maybe nobody else will.
And of course parents have their opinion, and so do the kids. That's the thing about school. We've all done it, so we all think we know what makes a good or bad teacher.
Come on, someone's got to have something else profound to why we study history.
Here's a look, then, at someone who the consensus says is a good teacher, even though he's only been at it for 1 year. It's one semester in the career of Brian Mason, a man who decided that with all the jobs there are in the world, none is more important than teaching American history to seventh graders.
This is my sanctuary. You know, I like to be in here because it's just you and the kids. As long as I have four walls, a place to teach, you know, and I have basic stuff, it'll all get done.
Is it when we first meet Mr. Mason, and despite his age, it does seem appropriate to use the formal Mr. Mason in the classroom. He's doing one of those things that you always expected teachers did during the summer, but I'll bet you never actually saw. Applying fadeless backing paper to a poster that says character. It's how you live your life when nobody's looking.
I'm not required to be here. I'm not getting paid to be here. Teachers do not have to report to August 30th. And some teachers will wait and set up only when you're going to get paid. But
his classroom at Lake Braddock Secondary School in Burke, Virginia, a few miles outside of Washington, D.C., is not actually in the school. The school's undergoing major renovation, and right now Mr. Mason and much of the rest of the junior high teachers are teaching in trailers spread out across the school's vast front lawn.
It's very narrow in the width, but a very long trailer, so it made the setup rather unique.
Though he has a master's degree in secondary education, teaching is not the only thing Mr. Mason ever thought to do, and it's not even what he wanted to do at first. Lousy pay, lousy hours, parents who look down on you and never feel it's not their place to criticize. How did he end up here in a trailer in August, working for no pay, putting up posters of sayings of John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King? Like that old bumper sticker used to say, thank a teacher.
And that's what Mr. Leonard, my seventh grade history teacher, he did great. He'd have the whole class believe in one thing. Well, yeah, that's right, Mr. Leonard. And then he'd go, well, what about, oh, yeah, Mr. Leonard, that's right. Well, what you guys just said. And that's really fun to do. So
that experience in seventh grade lit the spark, but typical of secondary school teachers, Mr. Mason decided late and on the spur of the moment to take up this profession. The big push in his case came from a college professor who was a retired public school teacher and, like Mr. Mason, a Civil War buff.
He said, Brian, he said, you're going to teach in 5 years. He said, if not, I quit. And I didn't believe him because I was like, there's no way. I was like, so I worked for a couple years just to pay the bills at a customer service center for a mutual fund company, came back to West Virginia University to get a graduate degree, started a master's in political science, thought, you know, a little too much research here, want to teach, so switched over to education, ended up with the education degree, and almost 5 years later, I was teaching. I saw him at Gettysburg. He asked me what I was doing, and I said, well, I teach seventh grade history. So that's how I ended up teaching history, because I wanted to do something that every day I could get up and feel good about what I'm doing.
So here he is at age 29, about to begin his second year in the classroom.
So my goal is to get the kids that love history to boom, okay, we're going to go out, we're going to research even more. Then there's the back row kids that every class has saying, I want to sit here, I don't want to be noticed, I've never really loved history. My goal is to get them to love history.
Would everyone please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
It's September now, the first week of school.
Let's go with Rebecca. Yes? No. Rachel. Kelly.
Yeah.
Yes, Kelly.
Though Mr. Mason has an education degree, like many beginning professionals, he says he didn't get a lot out of the college classes that, in his case, were designed to teach you how to teach.
I don't know. I think they can help teach you classroom management. I think they can help teach you organization. But can they teach you to teach? That becomes a question.
When you watch him work, though, and when you talk to the experts, you find that a lot of what he got in college did stick with him. Let's take a look at one of the most important aspects of any teacher's work, classroom management.
I'm sorry, I'll wait. How rude of me to talk while you're talking. Jeez, I just keep forgetting my man. No, wait, I think I have permission to talk and you don't.
Do you consider yourself a hard ass or a disciplinarian?
Yes and yes. So for me, what I do is I start off relatively strict at the beginning of the year. You got to make sure they know you're serious. Capiche? Did we go over what capiche means yet? Capiche is okay, or I understand in Italian. So I say capiche question mark, you say capiche exclamation point. We're going to do that a lot this year. Okay, ready? Let's try it. Capiche?
Capiche.
Not bad for about 7:40 in the morning. Excellent. Okay.
While teaching is as much an art as a science, experts will tell you that when it comes to setting rules and sticking to them, Mr. Mason is right on track. Dr. Ronald Sterling is a professor of education who teaches future history teachers at the University of Cincinnati.
Get strict and stay strict and then loosen up as the year goes along. As you get to know the kids and the kids get to know you, they find out that this is going to be learning first and maybe have a little bit of fun learning as we go along.
You should think to yourself when you come in the morning, okay, is my pencil sharpened? Do I have a couple pencils sharpened? Because if I'm in the middle of a lecture, if you interrupt me by saying, Mr. Mason, can I sharpen the pencil? It may just kill the whole mood.
It's only September, but already Mr. Mason says he can tell that this year is going to be easier than last, and not just because last year was his first full-time in the classroom. Last year, he says he had a tough group of kids.
There's years that they just say, oh my goodness, look out. I don't know if it's parenting, if it's genetics, if it's just teachers have good years and bad years, and maybe those kids came up when their first grade teacher had a bad year and they never got the discipline they needed. I can't answer that, but you can ask all the seventh grade teachers this year, and they're all so much happier.
Once again, the experts will tell you he's right on the money.
I've been supervising student teachers now for 31 years, and you always get the teacher saying, boy, I've got the class from heck this year, and you know, you always hear that.
So Sterling says the trick becomes spotting and then diffusing the troublemakers. Mr. Mason says spotting them is instinctual, and again, many experts agree, but when it comes to what to do with troublemakers, there, Mr. Mason may be out on a limb. Take the kid who always wants to be the center of attention.
Well, the center of attention, you just ignore. And then if it gets to a point that where they keep doing it, then you embarrass them in front of the class, and you give them the attention that they want, just not in the way they want it. You're supposed to. Okay, you are instructed to stand in front of the class, and we all go, you, 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 you. That way, you are nice and embarrassed.
Not the best way to go, according to Dr. Jesus Garcia of the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and president of the National Council for the Social Studies.
When you're in that area, you tend to be attacking the student rather than the behavior.
Dr. Sterling agrees, and he says this kind of discipline might actually backfire.
After you embarrass them, you don't want them to be sitting there thinking about, boy, that was really nasty, and I can't wait till the next time when I get a chance to do something, and I'm going to do it.
Both these experts say the way to handle troublemakers is not during class time. They say leave it for afterward.
If you get them right after class and say, Richard, I got to carry this stuff down to the car, or I got to do this, then you have a little opening maybe that will happen in class someday.
And while both Dr. Sterling and Dr. Garcia say this approach to discipline might come back to bite Mr. Mason down the road, they're both confident that he's smart enough and self-critical enough not to let it get in his way. In fact, after listening to much of the sound gathered to produce this report of Mr. Mason teaching and raw tape of our interviews, Dr. Garcia is so high on Mr. Mason, he actually goes so far as to give him this compliment.
I think he's the teacher of the future.
Like that. Now, in just a few minutes, I'm going to give you a packet. It's going to have a PBS website you can go to called The Gold Rush, where it'll have all sorts of cool quotes from actual miners themselves.
That assessment of teacher of the future probably has a lot more to do with the way Mr. Mason has managed to integrate technology into his classroom than his discipline strategies. Now, the way he has brought technology in is not the way that a software vendor would like. His is not some futuristic classroom with kids zipping through screens of educational software. Mr. Mason knows that it's not the computers themselves that make the difference. Computers are a tool, like chalk or posters, or any of the hundreds of visual aids teachers have used over the years. The technological integration he's pulled off, while prosaic, is nonetheless fairly revolutionary compared to what's going on in comparable schools. For instance, Mr. Mason is a lecture guy. He believes in talking and having kids take notes. He says that's the best way to prepare them for college. But despite that, you'll almost never see him touch the blackboard.
My handwriting is the worst thing in the world. So what I'm doing this year is I've put all my lectures on PowerPoints. There's going to be some problems put up for you on the screen. You guys are going to solve those problems.
While lecturing is still an old-school way of teaching, Mr. Mason has exploited the idea of the computer as a visual aid and taken it to its nth degree.
I've been able to put in graphics, to put in quotes, to put in some animation, some flowcharts, but it works unbelievably well.
Ideally, what should kids be using computers for in the school context?
Each classroom should be equipped with one of these projectors. There should also be a wireless lab in each classroom where the students should be able to have their own laptops they could take out during class.
What are you planning on using computers for in this coming semester?
The first project they're going to do is they're going to do an interview with somebody from the Old West.
The kids put together a mock newspaper called Mason's Monthly News, where they publish these interviews, complete with pictures.
All right, Emma, you didn't have a topic yet? Okay, Emma, you are going to interview a Chinese immigrant worker who worked on the Transcontinental Railroad. They're required to use internet sources. They're required to type it. They're required to add in some sort of picture. And I think that's great too, because again, it does make learning so much easier. They don't have to wait
for the ranch owner. Do I just like make an interview, like what's his daily life?
What's your daily life like? How big is your ranch? When do they come to pick up the cattle from your ranch? What are the dangers of living on your ranch?
This sort of deeper inquiry that the internet allows students to make by offering access to primary source documents and music and maps is precisely the thing that education experts want and expect computers to bring students today. Cheryl Lemke is CEO of the education consulting firm The Metairie Group.
In the past, many classrooms have been in situations where students are answering questions the way that the teacher wants them answered. And in these new situations, we see students answering the questions because they're intrinsically motivating and interesting to the student, and the student digs deep in order to get the answers that they want to find out.
The kids at Lake Braddock don't have laptops in every classroom, so all the Old West research will be homework. More on the problems with that in a second. But one more point on the positive side is what Mr. Mason has been able to do with the one computer he does have. Because of the web, Mr. Mason's class is able to cast aside one of the most revered or reviled items in the grade school experience, the social studies textbook.
We barely use a textbook in my class because I look at it this way. I would never tell you to go home and read a textbook for fun because I wouldn't do it. So what I do is each unit, they get a packet of different sources, websites, everything. That we read from that. We do notes. We do discussions. We read from these packets, which I have taken off of the internet. Yes, I spent my summer finding great sources for you guys off the internet. And places now are scanning in primary documents. They're scanning in pictures. There's quotes there. I mean, it's just so, you can learn so much. We're going to open up our packet. Okay, we're going to flip to these pages that say the Chisholm Trail. Okay, we're going to flip to the big page that has the big eye on it.
This idea of the teacher of the future often comes up in conversations about the use of technology in schools. What you'll often hear, despite the fact that computers have been in schools since the 70s, is once we have a cadre of young teachers and administrators who've grown up with technology, that computer use in the schools will take off. Put that proposition to Mr. Mason, though, and you'll find that the teacher of the future is more than a little skeptical.
I'm going to speak frankly and say that's crap. And I'm at the point where I'm not mad at anybody at Lake Braddock or anybody at Fairfax, but I'm mad at people who say that.
He says teaching with technology is like doing anything with machines. Look at cars, he says. They're great till they break down. And with today's computer-assisted cars, like computer-assisted classrooms, when they break, they're even tougher to fix.
Used to be, if you broke a piece of chalk, you'd get out a piece of new chalk. With the computers, you can't access your PowerPoints. You know, then you can go back to writing, but you lose all that effort you put in. So
research suggests that the lack of technical support continues to be a prime culprit keeping teachers from using technology effectively. The Fairfax County Public Schools do offer courses in technology for teachers, but with teaching, grading papers, going to meetings, running detention, coaching teams, Mr. Mason is the debate coach, and living your real life, who has time? And no amount of training can address every problem a teacher faces in the classroom. Look at what Mr. Mason encountered when he arrived in August. He had to put all his PowerPoint slides on the classroom desktop. Then he had to figure out how to run them. With Windows XP at home, he didn't need to install a driver. At school, he did. There was a driver online, but because it was August, he couldn't get online. On top of that, his desktop was clear across the classroom from his projector.
There's two different outlets on either side of the room, and my big fear is they're going to tell me I need to move my desk all the way to the other side of the room. Otherwise, I have to buy a $70 wireless adapter, which is, as a teacher, money that you don't have.
That $70 isn't the end of it. In fact, he wouldn't even be considering using PowerPoint if he hadn't had help from outside the school system, mostly from his parents, who bought him the projector.
That was $1,000. Anytime that bulb breaks, that's $300. My fiance is letting me use her laptop.
When you're talking about technology, money is not just a problem for Mr. Mason. Let's take that homework assignment on the Old West. Here's the Metairie Group's Cheryl Lemke.
When these students go home, some of them have computers and can spend hours at producing these reports or researching on the internet, whereas the students who are more low socioeconomic have 50 minutes, or they can go to the library after school, but they don't have it in their home to do it.
Mr. Mason says problems like that tripped up him and his students a number of times during his first year.
Some economically disadvantaged kids who don't have access two computers, we said go to the library. But they're the parents who have to work two jobs or maybe a single family. It's not easy for them to get to the library.
He's a lot more careful now to take economics into consideration. Economic disadvantage also comes into play elsewhere. Mr. Mason's school system has an internet program called Blackboard that allows teachers to post classwork and homework assignments online for students to access anytime they want.
A rich kid's out. Right, his parents go home, they download it, it's no problem. I look like the best teacher in the world. But that kid whose dad is working for two jobs, he leaves at 4 in the morning, isn't home till 10 at night, they don't even own a computer. And this kid's out all the time. When does he get the makeup work?
He's talked with his colleagues and the school administration about this, trying to show them how Blackboard could actually be widening the economic gap. Money's also a problem when it comes to something we alluded to earlier, the idea of laptops in the classroom. Here's Cheryl Lemke on the way it should work.
Conventional thinking is that the computers belong in the classroom where the learning is happening.
Mr. Mason would love to have laptops in the classroom, but without them, all he can do is go with his kids to the school's computer labs, or more often, they don't.
Let's say you schedule the computer lab for a day in February. it snows. The computer lab's already booked the following days. You've then promised the kids these presentations or whatever they would be doing in the computer lab. Now they can't do it. Now you got to come up with two extra days.
And even if they get into the labs, as Dr. Garcia of the National Council of Social Studies points out, that's no guarantee any work will get done.
When you go into the lab, four or five of those computers will not be working, or, you know, a whole host of other things may happen. I mean, good teachers are ready to say, okay, let's leave the lab, go back to the classroom. I've got a backup lesson that will cover some of this, and we'll come back to the lab later on, or we'll just skip that part of it.
He and Dr. Sterling say they train future teachers to prepare for the worst case when it comes to technology, because that's the situation they will most likely encounter. And not just in what you think of as bad or under-resourced schools. It's a comment on where we stand these days that a county's wealth is not reflected in how much technology it offers in its schools. In fact, the ratio is often just the opposite. When it comes to technology and tech support, it's actually best to be in an economically poor school district. In Mr. Mason's case, he says he almost chose to teach in a school in rural West Virginia primarily because of technology.
They had a projector in each classroom because the government was throwing money at them to say, okay, your kids are at a disadvantage, here's how we're going to help.
But being the teacher of the future doesn't just mean you know your way around a PowerPoint presentation. It's also about applying the latest concepts in teaching and actually making them work. Dr. Ron Sterling of the University of Cincinnati.
We don't teach the facts so much as we teach big ideas now. We teach concepts. And we believe a lot in constructing knowledge nowadays and letting the kids, first of all, decide what they do know about something. And lo and behold, they do know stuff.
In other words, with American history, for instance, not just telling kids what happened, but allowing them to think through the problems that real people confronted in history in order to come up with their own solutions.
Let me set it up for you, and you need to listen so you understand what's going on here, okay? Now,
it's mid-October, and Mr. Mason is about to demonstrate how he puts this theory into practice to teach the settlement of the West.
You have just been given land by the United States of America. Somewhere in the Great Plains.
The traditional lesson would be to give the kids facts about the Homestead Act, including what real homesteaders did. Instead, Mr. Mason makes the lesson a problem-solving exercise. First, he lays out some scenarios. You get to Nebraska with a horse and wagon. There are no trees to build a house. The soil's so hard it breaks your shovel. No water. Hostile neighbors who say you took their land, no doctor for miles. Then Mr. Mason places the kids into pairs and has them list how they would solve these problems.
Okay, I will give you till just about, let's say, 7 after.
He puts the kids in the situation and says, now what would you do? And lo and behold, what they would do given that situation is very similar to what those early homesteaders had to do in their situation.
After the kids have come up with their solutions, Mr. Mason goes around the room and the kids all compare notes.
You can take whatever you had pulling your wagon and use that to take you to the doctor.
Okay. Kind of a bumpy ride, but it's probably a decent solution. Kate.
He lets them struggle with that. And after they struggle and then after they talk to him about it, and he kind of rates them and berates them in a nice way.
I am Luke, superhuman. My hands can go through the hardest rocks. Yes.
He's got their attention now, so he actually goes into what the Homestead Act was, what it did, and then he gives them the answers to the situation that he created.
In other words, it's back to the PowerPoint where, line by line, as he lectures, pertinent words and pictures appear on the screen.
You guys were homesteaders, okay? Now, homesteaders are people that settled the Great Plains under the Homestead Act.
So okay? Why not just give kids the facts?
It lets them prove, hey, I'm capable of making decisions. And I also think if they become part of history, now they're not just studying Homestead about Act settlers, they are settlers. What did I say about the bell not dismissing you? All right. With that said, enjoy your day.
The semester ends on January 31st. Next day is a teacher work day, a quiet time for Mr. Mason to reflect on the job he's done so far.
If I had to grade myself, I would probably go with a B-.
Part of his self-critical analysis is because he's feeling way behind where he ought to be if he wants his kids to learn everything they might need for the state's standardized history test at the end of the school year. Plus, when he looks at all of the classes he teaches, he says he's got about 10 kids who, it seems, just won't learn. Overall, though, he is thrilled with the way that over this semester he's been able to merge technology into his own teaching style to really improve the learning that's going on. PowerPoint, for instance.
They love the motion in it. They love the pictures in it. They love the quotes I've used. So that's one. Number two is I've gotten primary sources a lot more easily, a lot more quickly. I've been able to organize them better.
Voting. Right, if you vote, you might
like
vote to go
here to show the kids a petition from 1920s Nebraska that listed reasons why women should not have the right to vote.
The second one from the bottom was really stupid because the woman wants to rest and quietude.
Yes, meaning you want quiet.
Yeah, right. I mean, honestly.
He says teaching from primary sources is much better than teaching out of a textbook.
It takes it from being that dry, some people didn't want women to have the right to vote.
Because if they have tried living with a full day with like five kids in a house, there is at least 10 fights an hour.
While the state's standardized test will be the final word on whether his kids are learning more, Mr. Mason says he's already seen an effect. He's cut the number of D's and F's he's had to give out by more than half from his first year.
I think that's because kids are more involved.
If, like, a woman runs against a woman, like, political office, then, like, they'll, like, make up rumors and stuff.
Yes, that's exactly what number five is going to say.
And by the way, that B-minus Mr. Mason gives himself, that's not how the administration would grade him. The county school system sees great things ahead for Mr. Mason. He's tech-savvy and he knows his material. The perfect combination to take what technology offers, even inside a trailer with only two electrical sockets, and give his kids classroom moments some of them will hold forever. Even though Mr. Mason teaches history, in his classroom, the future is here.
Right, if Ann's a Native American, they go, Ann, we're going to give you and your tribe two choices. You can either move to this land called a reservation, which is the worst land in the world that we don't even want, and you can live there. Okay, it's like 1,000 miles away from here, but at least we'll let you live. Or, if you refuse to move, you can die. Those were the choices you were presented. And mind you, they had guns in your faces as they were saying this.
Teaching the Next Generation was produced by Richard Paul. Special thanks to Linda Burke, the principal of Lake Braddock Secondary School, and Sylvia Otten, director of the Office of Staff Development and Training for Fairfax County, Virginia Public Schools. This program originally aired as part of our ongoing series on education and technology, produced with support from the United States Department of Education. If you missed part of this show, or if you'd like to hear it again, you can. Just visit us online at soundprint.org, where you'll find links to more information, books, related episodes, and also listening links for our programs. That address again is soundprint.org. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. You can always get in touch with us. We want to know what you're thinking. Just drop an email to talkback@soundprint.org and remember to mention your local station. You can own a CD of your favorite Soundprint episodes. Just call toll-free 1-888-38-TAPES. That number again is 1-888-38-TAPES. T-A-P-E-S. Or you can order online at soundprint.org. On the next Soundprint, Canada is welcoming foreign workers with open arms and sending them back home just as quickly. The Wendy workers and the chicken catchers, next time on Soundprint. Soundprint is production assistant Nkechi Mogekwu and audio engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Lisa Simeone.